Welcome to the Mountain Life. I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak. This morning, we're excited to speak with Lindy West. Lindy West is the author of three best-selling books, including the New York Times bestseller and Hulu series Shrill. Her writing has appeared in places like This American Life, The Guardian, Cosmopolitan, GQ, Vulture, and Jezebel. And she's been hailed as a beacon of empowerment by women who may not conform to a narrow set of societal norms, that is, being thin, straight, and compliant. A quote-unquote trad wife, she is not.
But even in the midst of critical and commercial success, Lindy found herself in a deep depression, with her marriage and sense of self-worth hanging in the balance. Lindsay joins us this morning to talk about the two journeys of her new book, Adult Braces. Her solo road trip, full of natural wonders, kitschy roadside attractions, weird dudes in bars, and dashboard epiphanies, and her transformation from feeling like a passenger to being the authentic, active navigator of her own life. Lindy West, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Let's start out by talking about your writer's brain. I was getting such a kick out of your voice memos about Fat Daddy and all the tendrils of observation and extrapolations that you launched about his existence. And there was a bit about passing a store that was called Born to Be Sorry, that was miles of fascinating musings on what this store could possibly be about. And maybe you could share a little bit about how the writer's mind takes them on these kind of musings, this sense of trying to put all the puzzle pieces together. Is this imagination? Is this a you thing? Is this neurodivergence? What is this?
Great question. I mean, I wish I knew. And I guess I don't know what other people's brains feel like. But I will say that I tend to think that I don't have much to say. I don't know if it, like I it took me a long time to even identify as someone who wanted to be a writer because I just loved books so much, and I was like, writers are these magical people. And I'm just sitting here thinking about, like the origin of the word spoon, or I don't know, like what's actually interesting going on in my brain. But then I found, it's all about sort of connecting with people. And actually, we are all just sitting around thinking about why do we call it a spoon? Actually, I haven't even thought about that. Now I just made it up for this conversation, and now I need to go look it up. But who invented the spoon? You know what I mean? But I feel like making those voice memos, which is was really just me free associating in the van while driving, when you kind of you can't think too hard about what you're saying because you're thinking about driving a van, and changing lanes, and weird road signs are going by, and I just it was when I went back and read the transcripts, I was like, oh, I am having sort of an interesting inner monologue all the time, even though to me it feels boring. Do you know what I mean? And there was something kind of affirming about it that speaks to like my larger sense of self and like imposter syndrome in my career. Like I feel like I remember thinking in my 20s, like I can't be a writer. Like, nothing interesting or even very bad has ever happened to me. But the reality is that people we want to read each other's thoughts because we want to connect and we want to feel like a community and and maybe we laugh at moments of recognition, like, oh, I'm a weirdo like that, or and so what I've discovered over the years is that kind of nothing is too mundane. It just depends on how you present it and finding like a fun, relatable, funny, interesting way, to write about it. And so that's, I've always been a really voicey writer. Like I just write in my own voice. And so, yeah, I guess what I've discovered is that nothing is boring. Everything is interesting. And the older I get, the more true that is, and the more affirming it is for me as a writer. It's a relief, you don't have to wait for inspiration. You don't have to wait for something really, you don't have to wait for like your to survive a helicopter crash on top of a mountain in order to be a person who can write a book, you know?
Yeah, well, the banal is really 95% of life,
Yeah,
right?
exactly.
And so I remember a few years ago reading a thing about how they were trying to come up with a name for the next generation, which is kind of now being called Gen Z. But somebody was saying it's the meme generation. And I was like, what is this ridiculousness? But really, I understood it over time. It's like these ways that we are trying to find in an online life that most of us have a portion of our lives online, at least, these ways to connect and to relate and to recognize, as you say. So I think that you're right on with that. Well, although there's lightheartedness throughout your new book, Adult Braces, you don't shy away from getting deep in thought or emotion, and often some of those most emotional moments happen in those audio clips. How do you feel those moments of raw, pithy insights are different from the stories you share in the more curated, edit-rich process of writing?
Thanks for asking. The voice memo transcripts are such an important part of the book to me. And I got some pushback in early drafts, like, oh, I don't know if you need this. And I was like, I think I do, because there's this, I'm really, really trying in this book to get at something authentic. And I've always tried to be very honest in my work, but I feel like this book goes even a little bit farther, and it's really, really honest and really true. And something I find when you write in hindsight, you're always polishing and kind of posturing a little bit to make the past or past you seem a little bit smarter or a little bit cooler. And using the unedited, I mean, they're edited, but like they're not changed, they're not substantively edited. Voice memo transcripts, it puts you in that moment with me in the van. And here's where my head was at that day. It's very unvarnished, and immersive, which is what I wanted. And I don't know if you've listened to the audiobook, but we did a really cool thing. In the audiobook, we used the actual voice memos
Yes, I did
rather
listen to them.
than, yeah. So rather than me re-recording them and trying to mimic my tone, we used the actual thing, even though the sound quality is bad and it's a little bit, I didn't even realize how I processed all the files for that. And then I was like, and I didn't know we were going to do that when I was writing the book. And so then I was like, oh man, I really like in the transcripts, I took out all these ums and and then also I discovered that in a bunch of them I'm crying, which I didn't even know because I only reread, I read them as transcripts.
Yeah.
I recorded them at the time, but it's like 12 hours of recordings, and then I just fed them into a transcription machine. So anyway, I have already committed to using these files, and then I go listen to them, and it's like, and then I'm driving by a beautiful river. Like it's like, whereas in the text it just reads like, I'm driving by a beautiful river. Oh, what a nice day. And then I'm like sobbing on the recording. But it's kind of amazing. I mean, what's more raw than that? I'm like, I don't know. I feel like I deserve a Grammy for my audiobook. So if you could let people know to vote
We
for me.
will let them know. I agree.
Thank you.
Well, most definitely. And especially the fact that it was impromptu and improvised, and you did not know at the time that you would be exposing this to the world.
Yes.
Well,
Yeah.
speaking of being vulnerable, wow. It's like your voice memos, or like when someone is writing in a journal and it's just flow of consciousness, and they, and I mean, it must be so exposing even to you to go back, like someone who goes back and looks at their journal and says, "Wow, is that really who I am? Is this, was it a big window into who you are that you didn't even know about?"
Yeah, I mean, I started doing it because I was really into journaling at the time, which I need to get back into because it's very good for my brain. But I discovered that I had not planned the road trip particularly well, and so there were just a lot of like 8-hour drive days where I didn't have time to get up and journal. And so I was like, oh, well, what if I just kind of reassociate into my phone? And so I did really use it as a journal. And so there is a lot of really embarrassing stuff. And like I said, it's probably 12 hours of recordings. And I don't know how much made it into the book. 1 hour? I mean, maybe. So, I'm not that brave to actually put my naked journal entries into a book, but it still is vulnerable, and it does, you know, I was a little bit brave, but yeah, some of it was like too embarrassing. And that stuff didn't make it. But maybe someday I'll be. But it's not even interesting. Also, a lot of it's boring. A lot of it's like, oh, you know, oh, there's a there. I wonder what that building's for. Oh, there's a cow. You know, I don't
Yeah,
know.
gotcha.
Not everything is ready for the public.
Prime time. If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with writer Lindy West. She's the author of the New York Times bestseller and Hulu series Shrill, and the author of a new book called Adult Braces. Well, since when we got the interview solicitation for Adult Braces, I mean, I looked at the title and I honestly just thought this was about the trials and tribulations of having adult braces. And so, I mean, if we're all being honest with ourselves, when we run into a friend who is an adult who has braces, there's that moment where we go, oh, and then there's the next moment where we go, I wish I were brave enough to straighten my teeth as an adult. Instead, I'll just go for Invisalign, you know. But you first introduce it in the book by saying how it's grinding on the side of your cheek or making your cheek raw. Every person in the world knows what this is like. But was there really an adult braces kind of come to Jesus moment for you?
I had to get braces in 2020. Because not for cosmetic reasons, but because my bite was misaligned and it was damaging my teeth. And this was really out of left field. I did not know that I needed to get braces. I didn't have braces as a kid. I was always very proud. My teeth came out perfect, and that was part of my identity. And then all of a sudden my dentist is like, okay, you're 39 or however old I was, 38, time to get braces. And I was like, I don't want braces. You know, like, what do you mean? But I also know myself, and I was like, I can't do Invisalign because I won't do it. I mean, even right now, I'm supposed to wear my retainer every day. I didn't even remember to bring it on this book tour. I haven't had it for a month. I was like, there's no way I'm gonna wear the Invisalign tray 24 hours, 23 hours a day. I'm not gonna do it. And so I was like, I gotta get the metal ones that they glue on and you can't take them off. And it was really hard at first. I mean, it wasn't hard, but I was just like, it was a it do, it does cut it cuts up the inside of your mouth. You can't brush your teeth in a normal way. It's really annoying, and you kind of look like a giant overgrown baby or, you know, child. And I was not that happy about it. But then I went on the road trip with my braces. And there was something about them that was kind of disarming. Like, people were just nice to me in a different way. And people were asking me questions about my braces. And I think it just, I don't know. I got to this point where I kind of liked having braces. And I mean, I hated it, but I was happy to get them off. But there is something about it that instantly generates this warmth from people because you have this obvious sort of foible on your face where people are like, oh, brother, look what you're doing. And it was kind of sweet. I don't know, like, disarming is the best word I can come up with. And people would tell me about their braces, and people would, you know, tell me about how they hated having braces so much that they ripped them off with pliers, and their parents never forgave them, you know. It became this sort of conversation piece that was really kind of unique, and I couldn't have replicated. So yeah, I was a little sad to see them go, like, because now I'm just my regular self, and my teeth are probably moving back to where they were because I never wear my retainer.
Well, what a nice unexpected bonus it was to have that
Yeah,
sense
and
of
it's funny because
accessibility.
it was this thing I was dreading, and then it became, you know, not that bad. It was something. It became like, And it also became a great metaphor for the book because the book is about all these different ways that I had to sort of painfully and slowly adjust the structure of my life. And I was like, oh my God, it's like braces because you can just move your teeth around. And you can also do that with your life, turns out.
Yes, you can.
So I, as soon as I realized that, I was like, because originally I was going to call the book Driving to Kokomo. And then I was like, the book is called Adult Braces.
I
And
love it.
it all came together.
I think that underneath every funny writer is usually a very intelligent person and a keen observer. But the super smart ones, like you, are the ones who make you laugh while also making the reader feel smart and cool by catching references and noticing all of the artful ways that everything is woven together. There are little treasures sprinkled all over Adult Braces, little one-offs like Take That, Richard Jewell, or describing the weird dude in the bar as bejorted. The use of perspicacity. I mean, even lyrical throwbacks in Kalamazoo when you were happily observing that it seems to me some fine things have been laid upon my table. I was dying. Do you delight in these little nuggets as you write them? I mean, are you cracking
Yes.
yourself up?
Yes, constantly. And thank you for noticing my little nuggets because no one has mentioned that yet. And I was so proud of it when I realized some fine things had been laid upon my table.
Oh,
When I had already earlier in the book referenced Desperado, and then I got to that
exactly.
point, and it was a and like the Desperado reference was about like letting love in, and then I get to Kalamazoo, and my friends have like broken into my hotel room and left me a bunch of treats all over my table. I mean, there's nothing but for me, there's nothing better as a writer. I don't know if other writers care about that, but that's like I tried. It makes you feel so smart.
It does.
It's
It does.
really great for the ego. And I did, especially in like a lot of the chapter titles, there's like little references that you may or may not even notice. And yeah, I mean, I hope that down the line this book gets enough consideration that people find them all. I mean, that would be my dream. But yeah, I don't know what kind of writer that makes me, but it's my favorite thing. It's my favorite thing to stick in a tiny little treat and then hope that someone finds
I think it
it.
makes you a fantastically human writer. It's like tiny, wonderful little Easter eggs. It's perfect. Well, you mentioned your friends and the wonderful things that they had laid upon your table. You seem to have a lot of fun with your friends, and that friendships are very important to you, and you're exceptionally present with your friends. What kinds of things do you notice in a new person that tells you, yep, you're one of my people? This person is going to be my friend, and we are going to have a good time.
Oh, what a nice question. I always am looking for people who make me laugh and who laugh at my jokes. That's probably the number one thing. People who make me feel calm instead of stressed. It's really important. I have a podcast with my best friend. It's called Text Me Back. And she's my best friend from since high school. I mean, I have many best friends, but one of my best friends, Megan, my co-host, we met senior year of high school. And the origin story is basically like we were signing up for classes in the gym and we were standing next to each other and a mutual friend introduced us. And then one of us said some obscure reference to some stupid TV show we were obsessed with that no one would ever have gotten. And then the other one was like, oh. And it was this moment of like, oh, you're like me. Like, oh, do you, oh, you tape David Letterman on VHS every night and, or whatever. Like, you have a creepy library of videotapes. And it was like, I don't know, I guess you can just feel it. I guess there's not really criteria. It's just like sometimes you have chemistry with a person, just like you have romantic chemistry with a person. You can have platonic chemistry. And so I really cherish that. It's really, really important. And the book is marketed and certainly has been received as being about my marriage, my romantic life, but I would say as much as, if not more, of the book is about like platonic love and infatuation and like the value that that can have in your life. And And just the importance of having people that see you and understand you and that can make you laugh at, with abandon and most importantly, don't stress you out. I love getting to just hang out with my dumb friends, and be stupid. It's the best.
Yeah, it is. It's funny. I've been examining that recently because it seems like in spring is the time where you start to, well, do road trips and you start to do things like two of my girlfriends just went to Death Valley to look at the spring super bloom.
Oh,
And
yeah.
just so random, but so wonderful and really putting a value on doing new things together. Well, this kind of leads me into my question for you about road trips. I mean, Adult Braces is in large part kind of talking about this road trip that you did. And I think road trips are such a time of discovery. And I've been stuck here in beautiful Park City since January. And just last week, we just went to the desert road trip. There is nothing in the world like a road trip. And I don't know why. And that's why I'm going to ask you to tell me what it is for you, because I know you'll describe it in such a great way.
I love the feeling of freedom and discovery. I am kind of shy. I'm not the kind of person who's striking up conversations with strangers all the time. And I'm not the kind of person who, it's like I want to know everything, but I'm too scared to ask. And there's something about a road trip where it just forces you outside. Like you have to stop at a gas station and go to the bathroom and pump your gas, and like people talk to you, and it just, there's so much opportunity for chance, and it just feels so much more immersive than flying. And I hate flying for a million reasons, and I love driving. Like sometimes if I'm in a bad, if I'm upset about something, or stressed, and we have to go somewhere, my husband will say, "Oh, I can drive." And I say, "Actually, I would like to drive. Like it's very meditative for me. It calms me down. It makes me feel better." So I love driving. I love being sort of private and public at the same time. Like I'm out in the world, but I have my little hidey hole with all my things. Especially a van, a camper van is so fun because I can have like all my bedding from home. Like I have all my little pillows, and I don't know. It feels like safety and adventure at the same time, like safety and exposure, and I just, there's a re I mean, we call them flyover states. Like I wanted to know what was happening in all the parts of the country that I don't know, because it's allegedly my country as well. And I feel like it's important to move my body through all of these places that are kind of mysterious to me, and derided as kind of boring or backwards, or as a coastal elite. Because it's not, that's not true. That's not what I found. I found beautiful things and beautiful people every single place that I went on this road trip. And there wasn't one state where I didn't say at some point, like, "Oh, I could live here. I see why people love this place." And so I just, there's just something so impersonal and sad and corporate about flying. And I hate it. I don't want to be in the tube, like trapped. And like, yeah, I guess you could talk to the person next to you, but like, no thanks. I don't want to do that. Because you're, it's like, at least if a weird guy talks to you at the gas station, you get to get back in your van and drive away.
You can
And so
escape.
then it that you can escape. Yeah. And I know that obviously like driving and fossil fuels are not compatible with my larger values, but boy, do I love driving.
Well, you mentioned in one part of your book that fat people love riding in cars because you have that insulation around you, and yet you have all your stuff. And if you want to go through a drive-through, like there are a lot of things. And you discuss your relationship with food and your body in your writing, including some of the pitfalls that have come along with being a poster child for body positivity. In fact, Lizzo, Melissa McCarthy, Adele, Rebel Wilson, a lot of pillars of the body positivity movement have been shrinking lately. And you recall one comment someone made in relation to one of your posts that said, "Can we not see another body positive person losing weight?" So I'm wondering, like, as much as many people feel the pressure to lose weight, do you ever feel an opposite pressure to maintain a larger body because it's part of your story that so many people connected with?
Yeah, and that's a big thing that I write about in the book is realizing that I was feeling very confined by people's perceptions of me and the ways that people need me and what I represent to them. And what I have made myself represent. I mean, like I did this, you know, I built my own career and I, you know, I made body you know, body liberation part of my brand and whatever. And then I realized, like, oh, I don't feel particularly liberated because I don't feel like there's actually room for my body size to fluctuate, which it naturally does, depending on other factors in my life. And so what happened was during COVID, you know, well, there's nothing to do. I was like bored and stir crazy, and I just started walking a lot. I started hiking a lot. And then I was like, I wonder if I could jog. And I started running and I ran a 5K. And it was kind of just this experiment to like see what my body could do because I had suddenly the time and the brain space to do. I mean, I was desperate for anything to do. And my body did get a little bit smaller. And then I started to get backlash, which is a backlash that I understand so deeply because it does feel like a betrayal. Why would you not think that I was like on a diet trying to become thin and get rid of my fat body, because that's what everyone is constantly being pressured to do. I mean, you know, I understand so deeply why people do that. But I was just like living in my body and kind of challenging myself and having this like small epiphany about my abilities and my I don't know, the pleasure of moving my body and not being afraid. I mean, I'd spent so many years having people shame me. I mean, people shame fat people at the gym. They make fun of fat people for not going to the gym, and then they make fun of you at the gym. It's like, and I was finally able to release some of that and remember that I do get joy from moving my body and like pleasure, and it feels good, and I love being tired. So anyway, all of these beautiful things were happening, and then I realized that people were mad at me for it because of the way that I had set up my public persona. And that really didn't feel good. It felt like this sort of very constrictive, sad, like cage. And what I really wanted was not to be fat or be thin or be anything. I just wanted to have an authentic relationship with my body, and I wanted to have agency and autonomy. And you know, we talk a lot about body autonomy, and we talk a lot about, you know, in the body positive or fat positive community, like we talk about fat people needing to or deserving to have a healthy, nourishing relationship with food and a healthy, nourishing relationship with exercise. And then, but of course, everyone is wounded and scared and suspicious to see someone like me. And it's not like I became thin. I became like very, very slightly less fat, but people noticed immediately. You know, I was still fat, but people noticed, and it was like, oh my God, you know, she's. I think Ozempic didn't exist yet, but it was like, you know, people were like, what's she doing? Did she have a surgery? Like, because it would be it is a betrayal in a certain way, and it's so complicated because I can see and feel deeply both sides of it. But I was just in this space of like, I need to be able to use my body however I want. That what else is the point? Anyway, and then I got depressed and I ended up getting fat again, and it's or fatter again, and it's fine. So now they're not mad at me anymore. But it was really important for me to address that feeling of like I used to feel sort of obligated to lose weight because of people who hate fat people. And then all of a sudden I felt this obligation to never lose weight because I feel beholden to fat people who I love. So it was this bind that really left me no room for freedom. And so a lot of the book is me exploring like how do I live in a state of feeling free while not betraying my community and not falling, you know, back into the the under the spell of diet culture, which is very, very powerful and insidious. So it's complicated, you know?
It really is. And let me ask you this. We're living in a time when it's clear to most people that commenting or disparaging someone's race, disability, mental capacity, sexuality, et cetera, is not appropriate and even grounds for cancellation, depending on what someone might say. But so many people seem to feel completely at ease with commenting about bodies, whether it's the size of bodies or cosmetic surgery or aging. What do you think gives them that sense of license to comment about something that isn't theirs?
Well, I want to say that, of course, a lot of fat phobia is based in racism, and it's not, there's rampant racism everywhere around us, and misogyny, and all of these things are still very powerful, and you don't really get canceled. You know what I mean? Like, look at the president. Which we don't have to get into, but there is a way that I think, because everyone has a body and everyone is constantly being tortured by diet culture, that people feel, it's like projection, right? It's like people see a fat person who is happy and they say, well, but I'm miserable, like starving myself and spending all my money on my personal trainer and hating myself every single day, because I've been sold this idea that at the end of that rainbow, when I'm finally thin and perfect, then I'll be happy. And you're saying that you're happy now. Like, it feels like fat people are cheating. You know what I mean? Like, fat people who refuse to hate ourselves are like g gaming the system and cheating and skipping the line, like teleporting to the finish line in a way that is really emotionally intolerable for people who have been trying so hard to attain this unattainable ideal that they've been told will make them happy and make their life perfect. So I think there's just like a lot of pain and a lot of stigma, and people are always looking for it makes you feel good to look at the world like a hierarchy of value. And if fat bodies are at the, if there are people whose bodies are worse than yours, then you get to lift yourself up a little bit. And I think that's kind of an easy hit of dopamine or whatever the chemical is that I can't remember. I can't remember which chemical does what, but it's an easy way to feel better for a minute, even though it's not, it's just a band-aid. It's not actually helping you at all. And it's really hurting the people around you. And it's really hurting yourself, because you have a body too. And like, do you really want to be part of someone else's body hierarchy where they look at you and they say, oh, too bad, you know? What's d a disgusting way to live.
Yes. This is so insightful, and it just kind of rolls off your tongue, Lindy. I mean, and this is the way your writing is too. It just, your insights are brought off your tongue with these words that make great connectivity. And you're not even, I don't even think you're pre-thinking about it. It's just coming out, and it's wonderful. And this also, though, is part of the vulnerability and how brave you are to put yourself out there. And there's no lack of, commenting on social media and around about the work that you do, whether it's talking about body shaming, body positivity, your relationship with your husband, anything you do. But you're hanging it out there. What would you say? I mean, I always feel when people get really roused up on social media. I try not to read it actually, but when I do and I see people so incensed about things, I just feel like it's they're holding the mirror up to themselves, and it's a reflection of their own pain. And you've made yourself a human punching bag in a way for that. What and I guess thank you for doing that, but how do you what's the antidote to that reflection of people's own pain?
Oh man, I don't know. People keep asking me, especially because there's been some backlash to this book. It's like, why did you do this? Like, why did you write something so intimate and personal? And I don't know that I have an answer. This is just the thing that I know how to do. And I wasn't writing the book thinking like, oh, I'm gonna generate discourse. I really was just trying to write something. I was just trying to write a good book that felt true. And for years and years, I've seen the way that people respond to my work and the way that I have some kind of a knack for helping people feel less alone. And that is the most rewarding feeling when people come to me and they cry and they say that I've helped them in some way. And that's just the thing that I know how to do. I don't know. And the antidote to, I don't know, to people's projections and insecurities, I don't know. I kind of think that it's just more of what I'm already doing. I mean, I think people are really afraid of being sincere because it's embarrassing and it opens you up to being wrong. And it's a lot safer to stay kind of jaded and defended. And so that's another reason why I write the way that I write. It's just to sort of provide a model of like, look, it's okay to have big feelings and to be complicated and to be honest and let people see you. I feel like it's valuable to show people that it's not the end of the world if people make fun of you, or like, as long as you know that you're telling the truth and that you're doing this in good faith, which I am. I've always found that vulnerability is really powerful, and it's a real strength, because if you make yourself super vulnerable and you show people who you are and you show people your like soft underbelly or whatever, and then they're mean to you, they look bad, And so it's much more dangerous to, I mean, it, I, this is contradicting what I just said, but what I mean is like, it feels like safety to be jaded and to be, very careful with what you say and to be sort of posturing and playing a character that you think is cool. But it's actually, to me, it's much more dangerous, because then you have the possibility of people puncturing your fantasy and saying, and like d exposing you as kind of a fraud. And so I don't ever want that feeling. I would rather people make themselves look mean and small by making fun of a person who has put herself out there in an honest way, than people being like, look at this dork trying to make us think she's cool. No thanks.
Right. In the beginning of the interview, Lindy, you said something about imposter syndrome. And I think you were referring to yourself, like you never really thought of yourself as a writer, but here you are. I mean, as we said in the intro, you have been published in all these like huge magazines and different places. So you're not an imposter. I think imposter syndrome is huge. I've been hosting this show for 15 years and I still feel like I'm not a radio professional, And I just wondered if you could comment on imposter syndrome. Is it just something that we do to keep ourselves humble, or what is it? What is imposter syndrome, and is it a thing you ever get over?
It's so hard and kind of insidious, because I remember, I don't know, some years back reading some really interesting critique of the idea of imposter syndrome as this very gendered thing that, like, oh, men don't experience imposter syndrome. In fact, a man will walk into a job for which he is wildly underqualified and like boss people around. And so I hesitate to talk about imposter syndrome as this sort of foible, or this like mistake that women make, as though it's something that is coming from within us and not something that's being pushed on us externally, where we're not taken seriously and we're not treated with kind of respect, and we're not validated and lifted up in the same way that a man might be in the same job. So I hesitate to just say use imposter syndrome without a little caveat or context, but it also feels so true. I mean, still to this day, like this book came out and there has been, a fair amount of writing about it, and so many people in critiquing the book were like saying things like, "Oh, Lindy West is the greatest success story of 2010s internet feminism." And I was like, "Me? Success? You guys don't know anything about my life." Like I which because truly I felt like I was sort of an online one of a million online writers in like 2011 to 2014, 15. And then I kind of dropped out. And when I was one of those writers, I just felt like one of those writers. And I always worked remotely. I was always up in Seattle. I didn't have like a community of writers. I didn't really understand what anyone thought about me. I always thought that they just thought I was a big dork. And then I kind of retreated from that. I started writing books, and then I've retreated even further now. And now I write a Substack about movies, and I do a silly podcast with my best friend. And I was like, but then I'm reading all these things about how I'm everyone's, not everyone's hero, but I'm like this great success and sort of a pillar of this time on the internet. And I was like, it truly was shocking to me because I just don't feel like that at all. And I felt like this, like a minor voice who had faded away to do my own little silly thing in my corner. So even to this day, I'm like, me? And I think, at the same time, my confidence in my own writing has grown. I'm really, really proud of this book. I'm really proud of the writing, the quality of the writing. I think it's on a different level from the rest of my work. So my confidence has grown in that way. But I don't know. I think that having sort of humility about who I am and my abilities in some ways like serves me. Like I don't want to be a person who I think you lose some of your insight if you become a person who is just sort of swaggering around being like, yes, I'm the best. I think it makes you less good. And so I just always want to be like open to the possibility that I'm wrong or irrelevant, and I want, because then I can keep an eye on it and try to, learn and grow where I need to learn and grow. So I don't
Well,
know.
and
It's complicated.
you're also Norwegian, so your inner Jante is going to act up
Yes.
from time to time, which tells you you're not so special. And these are
True.
cultural things that absolutely follow us into our adult lives, right? I mean, I got a kick out of that. There was at one point you were describing a day snorkeling in Key West. You say, "I was alone, I was fat, I was in my swimsuit. I felt simultaneously like everyone was looking at me and no one could see me." And in another part of the book, you remark, "I wanted to be 50% star, 50% invisible." Could you talk a little bit about that conflict between wanting to be seen and wanting to stay private?
Yeah, I mean it's the strange balance of my whole life. So my mom is Norwegian and my dad is was like my mom's very private and sort of controlled and very Norwegian. And my dad was a piano player and like a performer, and his parents were in radio. He came from sort of like a showbiz family, and I have just always felt pulled between those two poles. Like my mom specifically taught me to not never think that I'm better than anyone else, to never think that I deserve more attention than anyone else, which is really kind of like a beautiful, in my opinion, a beautiful idea. And in Norway, they have healthcare and education. So, it's this idea that like the collective is always going to be more important than your individual like showboating, and it's a very American sort of need to be exceptional and to become a billionaire and to like beat everybody else. And so I was definitely raised with that as a core value. Like, you're not special. You're not special, which sounds like a mean thing to say to a kid, because we're supposed to say, like, of course, all kids are special. But if all kids are special, then you're not special. And I think that that's right. And so I was never raised to think that I was special. But then also, my dad would be like, okay, we're gonna sing a jazz medley at the family reunion or whatever, And like, my dad always wanted me to play the piano and like kind of perform and act and follow in his footsteps. And I also, some part of me does think that I'm special. I know I just said that I don't think that,
I think
but
we think you're special.
well, thank you. I think you're special. I think everyone's special, but like, I did also have this hunger to sort of, I mean, once you learn that you can make people laugh, maybe not everyone feels this way, but for a certain kind of person, and I'm this person, you get addicted to it. I mean, all you want to do is make people laugh. And so I also had that going on. It's like, I want to be a good Yontas girl. And I don't want to draw attention to myself or, think too highly of myself or expect any special treatment. But I also want everyone to be l laughing at my jokes and listening to me at all times. But also, I'm shy and I don't want anyone to be looking at me. I mean, I was always sort of trying to navigate truly like bipolar opposite instincts. And I think I figured it out at this point, which is that you can just be like, I don't have to be an actor. I can be a writer, which is like everyone's paying attention to you, but you're also hiding in a room in your pajamas. So
Well, being a
it's
writer kind of is
a.
one way to straddle those worlds, right?
Exactly.
Because you can have the public facing part, and then you get to have this other part. Well, we're almost out of time, but as a last question, let me ask you this. You've done books, you write pieces, essays, you've written for the New York Times, you have had a hit show for 3 seasons. What haven't you done that you might like to do?
Guess what? I already know.
What?
I'm gonna write a novel. I'm very
Yes.
excited. Okay. I, in my whatever phase of life this is, early middle age, I've stopped reading books with integrity. I'm only reading the cheapest thrillers you can get your hands on and
Know.
mysteries. I just want anything that's like, I want there to be, I'm trying to piece the clues together. Something salacious is happening.
But
There's
at
a big
least
twist.
have proper clues. At least set up the
Yes.
structure
I don't
properly,
like when there's
people.
no proper clues.
Right.
So anyway, I think I'm going to try to write a mystery and I'm really excited. But it'll kind of also be like, I don't know that I really know how to write fiction, so it'll probably be a first person voicey mystery where secretly I am the person solving the mystery.
Well, you would not be the first person who writes in the voice of someone who's very much like themselves.
Exactly.
Well, it has been a delight speaking with you. We've been talking with Lindy West, fabulous person and author of a new book called Adult Braces. You've seen her work in the show Shrill, and you've probably read her pieces online or her other books. Lindy, we cannot thank you enough for being with us. Thanks for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me. This was a wonderful conversation.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lindy.
Thank
Yeah.
you. That was so fun.
So fun. Thank you.